Okay, the title of the talk is a signature of a wind reverse shock in gamma ray burst afterflow. I'm Asaf, and this work was done with in collaboration with Ralph Byers, just recently accepted for UpJ, and you can find it on the web down here. And I'd like to call it the three graphs talk, because what I want you to take out of this talk is basically an understanding of three graphs, which I will show you later on down the way of this talk. And as usual, the short outline of this talk is, I'll start with the motivation. What do I mean by wind reverse shock? Well, specifically massive stars, its gamma ray burst progenitors and the shocks that they produce. And then I will speak about the complexities of the ambient density profile that is produced. The majority of this work is on shock waves and collisions of shock waves. And of course, how these collisions of shock wave affect the dynamics of the plasma evolution. And of course, what we always have in mind is what are the observational consequences of all this work. And I'm a theoretician, so you find out that there's a lot of sort of hand waving and some ideas that are thrown to the air. So I'll start with the motivation. And those of you who work with modeling of gamma ray burst afterglow, or those of you who read papers on modeling of gamma ray burst afterglows, will find out that. That most of the works, or I would even say that all of this work that deal currently with modeling of afterglows, assume either that the explosion that produces the gamma ray burst occurs into a constant density medium, or in maybe a more sophisticated treatment, is that they assume that it goes into some density gradient that is caused by the wind of a massive star, that is assumed progenitor. And of course, today we know that there is a very strong connection that was established between gamma ray burst progenitors, or I should say long gamma ray burst progenitors, and massive stars. So presumably massive stars are the progenitor of at least a long gamma ray burst. I just named some of the recent observational results. The connection between gamma ray burst supernova 1 should be BC here. There are at least four, I think, today. You can correct me if you know more than that. Evidence for gamma ray burst in star forming regions, and so name some. and there are some other evidence. And as we all know, massive stars, presuming that these are the progenitors, are expected to emit wind prior to their final state, say the explosion. So at least in the final stage, which is presumably the Wolf-Rayet stage of a star, these stars are expected to emit wind. And actually, it's a supersonic wind. And as a result of that, the star, which is presumably later on at the final stage of its life, explodes and produces a gamma ray burst. The gamma ray burst blast wave has to propagate into some pretty complex density structure made out of this wind that was emitted from the star. And therefore, this wind is expected to affect the observable radiation from the gamma ray burst in its afterglow evolution. And let's see how. And this is a small scheme that gives you the basic ideas of what I'm speaking about. So take a massive star, and presumably in its last stage of its life, it's in the Wolf-Rayet phase. And of course, we had a lot of discussions about the low metallicity, which implies that the mass loss rate is presumably much lower than the typical Wolf-Rayet star. So I took your characteristic value of 10 to minus 6 solar masses per year. And anyway, the mass loss is in a form of a stellar wind, which is supersonic velocity of about the order of 1,000 kilometers per second. And this runs into the interstellar medium, which I don't know exactly what the value of it, but I take average values. And so what you have here is a supersonic wind that just runs into the interstellar medium.
That's a pretty huge value for the density of the interstellar medium. You're 1,000 particles per centimeter cubed.
That's true, but we are talking about star-forming regions of gamma ray burst. And in any way, we will see later on in the next slide, I think, or the next two slides, that the actual value here is just it's a parameter and it doesn't have a really strong effect.
It affects the size of the whole region.
Yeah, it affects the size of the whole region, but not too strongly. I'll show you that in a minute.
What if you use n ISM equals 1?
We'll show you that in a minute.
It makes a big
I've got.
Difference.
It doesn't make a big difference.
It makes a very big difference.
Wait two slides and we'll discuss that. Okay? Anyway, remember that we're speaking about star-forming regions which are expected to have relatively high densities. So we'll get to this in two slides. So just to explain the basic idea, so we have a supersonic stellar wind that runs into, say, constant interstellar medium. So because it's supersonic, it's like a piston that runs into it. So it drives a shockwave in front of it. So there is a shockwave that runs into the interstellar medium. This is the forward shockwave. And of course, the interstellar medium that just sits there doesn't know anything until the shockwave runs into it, and then it crosses the shockwave, and we have shocked interstellar medium. But one shockwave is not enough to reconcile for the thermodynamics of the problem here. So there is actually a second shockwave that runs into the wind. A nice way to view that is that if you sit in the wind frame, then you can see the interstellar medium runs into you supersonically. And so there is a second shockwave that runs into the stellar wind and that separates the stellar wind and a shocked stellar wind. This is the reverse shock. Obviously, it's not really, if you're an observer that sits here, it's not really a reverse shock. But if you're sitting here, you see this one moves from you and this one moves backward. That's why it's called a reverse shock. But of course, in reality, have in mind, both shockwave runs further out of the star. And of course, in between the two, the shocked stellar wind and the shocked interstellar medium, we have a conduct discontinuity that separates the two fluids. Both have similar energy density, but otherwise the parameters are different. Okay, so this is the basic picture. And now we run into the parameters. And this basic idea was solved about 30 years ago by Castro, Weaver, and McRae in 1975, and later on by Weaver et al. And another very important point that should be noticed here is that when you go, while the unshocked wind is supersonic, the shocked wind is, of course, subsonic, and therefore pressure gradient have enough time to smooth out instabilities inside. And so pretty roughly the density in this shocked wind region, which I denote region B, is pretty much constant. Of course, it's not exactly constant. I'll show you in a minute a slide that you have to take into consideration. There are some other effects like the radiative losses, etc. But it's pretty roughly constant. So generally, these are the four regions that we just discussed about. The region A is the unshocked wind, which is characterized by decreasing density. The density goes like R to minus 2. A shocked wind, which is approximately constant density. This is region A and region B. And then region C would be the shocked interstellar medium, and region D would be the unperturbed interstellar medium. And there are four free parameters of this problem, basically. These are the total mass loss rate from the star, the velocity of the wind, the density, which we just asked me about that, and the total lifetime of the emitting of the wind from the star, presumably the Wolf-Rayet phase. And when you do the numbers, that was done already 30 years ago, you find out that the reverse shock is of the order of 10 to the 18 centimeter, about 1 parsec. And here you can find the dependence on the free parameters. So you see that the dependence on the interstellar medium, which you just asked me about, is to approximately 1/3 power. So it could vary by, say, the order of magnitude. But I'm not worried about that, and you'll see soon why. But have in mind that this radius, I'm expecting it to be, and I call it R naught, this is the radius of the reverse shock, is the order of a parsec. And the radius of the forward shock, and that, again, that depends on the values of the parameters, the unknown values of the parameters that you assume here. And the radius of the forward shock is expected to be about 10 times larger than that. Another issue is that for...
Actually, that makes a big difference, the 1/3 parameter, because if you change the thing from 10 to the 3 to 1, you get the reverse shock out at 10 parsec rather than 1 parsec, which makes a difference between the thing crossing it and not crossing it. The last wave crossing it and not crossing it before it becomes C double and picks up its enough. So it makes a big difference to the whole.
Well, but there are other dependencies on other parameters as well. So I would say yes. If you go too far away at some point, and the reverse shock when it crosses it, it will be it will not be relativistic. But you see that there are other unknown parameters. For example, the total lifetime of the Wolff-Rayet phase of the star took here 10^6 years, so it might be a little bit smaller, so it will take you backward. So it gives you an order of magnitude estimate. And the reverse shock is expected to be strong, that is that the pressure in region B is much larger than the pressure in region A at R0, and that implies that we know what the density in region B is, just 4 times the density in region A at R equals to R0. And then there is one more important thing that we should note already now. Well, basically there are two things that can be noted now. The first one that I wanted to notice is that I use here values of about m dot of 10^-6 solar masses per year and total duration time of about 10^6 years. And that implies that the total mass in the wind, both shocked and unshocked, is the order of a solar mass. Give or take, can be an order of magnitude. And because of the total explosion energy, right, E is less than m solar times C square, that implies that the gamma ray burst blast wave cannot cross region B while it is relativistic. So in reality, we don't expect to have any observational effects from regions C and D. So all we have to concentrate is on what happens when the blast wave propagates in regions A and B, and of course in between, when it gets into the shockwave. So that's the first thing to notice. And the second thing to notice is, already from here you can see that clearly before we get into the shockwave, we are expecting to see something when we look at the afterglow. At early times it looks like an explosion into a density profile, which it really is. And then, at later times, after we cause the shockwave and all the what happens there at the transient phase ends, we expect that the explosion would look to us, the afterglow would look to us as if the explosion occurs into roughly constant density profile with slow density, because the density here is only 4 times higher than the density in region A here, which is the order of 10^-1, 10^-2, a few times 10^-2.
What is mu sub W?
Sorry? V, it's V, sorry.
Oh.
It's V, it's just...
V to the wind, okay.
Yeah, it's a wind velocity. I'm sorry for the PowerPoint fonts. Okay, and one of the critics that one told me about this graph is that okay, this is just a sort of cartoon that shows the basic ideas. But you know, if you go to reality and you take some more sophisticated treatment of how the plasma evolved, then it might be something different. So here I'm showing you some pretty recent work by Chevalier, Lee, and Franson from 2004, which did pretty similar calculations with a little bit different parameters, and they got pretty similar results. Look at the density profile, which is goes like an R^-2, and then pretty much constant. And they take into consideration radiative losses, which are, you know, probably resulting in this somewhat decay here. So I'm just going back to this graph because this was the first graph. I told you that there are three graphs that I want you to understand. How do I get to this graph? So this is the first of these three. So far?
I never read this paper by Kastor. What went into their calculation? What equation did they solve to get this? Did they...
Well, they've got the standard thermodynamic calculations of the work done by the wind, conservation of energy, conservation of mass. We can go over it later on.
Okay. It's actually a self-similar solution. If you have m dot and v, the m dot and v of the surrounding medium, you can calculate this solution. And if you have m dot and v for the wind, and you have a mass loss rate and a velocity or a density for the surrounding medium, if it's a constant, you can actually get this self-similar solution.
Yeah.
It's just a couple of lines. You can get a self-similarity, and if you just use the equations of motion, you can get the actual solution. The self-similar one won't give you the constant, that's all.
And so they assume no radiation.
The thin shell has to be cooled. In fact, it's completely radiative. Otherwise, you won't get the thin shell. So in order to get the thin shell, all the material is cooling, so it becomes absolutely thin, in fact. So that part is like, in fact, it's assumed the other way. Everything is almost radiative. To give it a thin shell. That's how you get the Weaver et al. Solution. So, but otherwise, you know, the radius and all comes directly from self-similar. You can actually easily calculate it.
So where is everything subsonic, where is it supersonic?
Well, it's pretty easy. Here you got a supersonic wind, but here it becomes subsonic.
That's subsonic.
Yeah, and
with respect to the interstellar medium, it's again supersonic.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
So first super, then sub, but for the interstellar medium, it is supersonic.
Yeah. Okay, so now that we got the density profile, let's go now and see what happens. And now. This big star that emitted all this wind and produces this wind bubble, as it's known in the literature, now it explodes and produces a gamma ray burst, assuming. And so the gamma ray burst propagates into this density profile, and here is, you know, some zoom up of region A and region B, and this is R naught, the wind of the reverse shock. And so we have a relativistic blast wave. So far, things were not relativistic, but now we've got a relativistic blast wave that runs into this density profile with some Lorentz factor gamma, which is a function of R, because at this later stage, we can assume that it's already self-similar. So we know this Van von Mackie self-similar solution for expansion into density gradient, and we get that for n that goes like R to minus 2, gamma of R drops as R to the minus f. So we know how to calculate the blast wave evolution in region A. And a very important another consequence to note is that because the expansion is relativistic, it compresses the plasma. So the widths of blast wave, which I denote now region A tilde, is R over 4, well, there's some numerical factor, depending on how do you count it, over 4 gamma square in the observer frame. Okay? So it's much compressed, so you can't really see its width in this scale. So as long as it propagates in region A, right, this is another cartoon that just aimed to show you what the idea now. We got region A and region B, that was the original shockwave that we had already, and wind flows from region A to region B. This is the stellar wind. But now runs the new relativistic blast wave, which forms region A tilde. It moves at relativistic speed, it is hot, and so it runs very fastly into region A, so matter from region A also accumulates to region A tilde. So actually matter flows from region A to region, first to region B, that's what we had all the time, and also now to region A tilde, whose width is, as I said, it's really compressed, so its width depends on R and gamma, so it goes like R over gamma square. And here is the same cartoon, and now this blast wave runs in region A, and at a certain point, it reached the original wind reverse shock that was there. So what happened now? First of all, again, matter from region A runs into region B and into region A tilde. But now, when it goes to this shock wave, first of all, there is no more region A, right? Region A is completely gone. Okay, so there is a new shock wave. This shock wave, the front shock wave, now splits into two. Forward shock continues to run into region B, but now with a different velocity, different Lorentz factor. And there is a reverse shock that runs backward into region A tilde. Okay, do you understand it? And therefore, matter from region B now goes through the front shock wave to a new region, which I call region C tilde, and matter from region A tilde, there is a reverse shock that runs into region A tilde, so matter from region A tilde now crosses this reverse shock to form a new region, which I call B tilde. Okay, and this is one important consequence, because what happens now is that while in region A, matter was flowing into region A tilde. So region A tilde was connected, it was downflow. So it sort of knew what was going on here. It could adjust its rent factor. But once we cross into this region, now matter flows from region A tilde backward. So matter in region A tilde doesn't yet know that something happened until the reverse shall cross it. So it continues to move with its Lorentz factor that it had at the time that it reached the wind reverse shock. Is it clear so far?
Cooling very rapidly or how fast? The cooling time
scale. Ah, that's what we have to calculate. That's one of the things. That was the main of the major calculation that was done here. That will be the next slide. But the picture, is the picture clear? Because it's confusing. I'll repeat it again. We got region A and region B, and there was a wind that flowed from region A to region B. That was the original wind reverse shock. And then there was this blast wave that formed region A tilde. And it just goes very rapidly, relativistically, into region A. And so matter was just sweeping up matter from region A. So matter from region A was just going into this region, which we denote A tilde. And when this blast wave just run into this wind reverse shock, there is no more region A. Okay? And so the forward shock now split into two. And one part continues to move into region B, and one part moves backward into region A tilde. Okay? And so matter from region A tilde now flows past this newly formed reverse shock, and matter from region B passed this through this newly formed forward shock, producing regions B tilde and C tilde.
May I ask maybe a question? So I understand how we go from one picture to another picture, but my question is that how it happens that this reverse shock actually is right when your strong shock passes through?
It's not the same reverse shock. It's a newly formed reverse shock. The reverse shock.
It passed this discontinuity, but it still didn't strike. Just somehow it wasn't switching on.
This reverse shock is gone now.
Yes, but your new reverse shock.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah.
When you pass that boundary, right?
You pass this. Yeah, when you pass this boundary, there is a new reverse shock that appears. It has to appear there because otherwise you cannot solve the thermodynamic equations. It has to be there to have self-consistent. Mathematically, it has to be there to have self-consistent solution. And physically, I think that the way to think of it. You have a density jump, of course, from region A to region B. So you get a shockwave that runs into a density jump. So when this happens, the shockwave has to split. That's the physical picture.
So when the shockwave has a contact discontinuity, you'll always get some kind. You'll again transmit a shockwave that goes through, and the pressure behind it is so high that it will actually push the material back, which is where you get the reverse shock from. So every time you have like interaction of shockwave and contact shockwave, the shock will get transmitted under reverse. I can show you in simulations. You get the transmitter, you increase the pressure because it compresses the shell. Remember, when you hit it, you're compressing it, and then it increases the pressure, and that pressure will actually drive the shockwave backwards.
Now remember that in the observer frame, all these shockwaves go forward. Mm-hmm. The terminology forward shock and reverse shock just refers to someone that sits here in the shock frame. He sees this. Shock moving forward and this shock moving backward.
How long does it take for the blast wave to reach the reverse shock of the wind?
Sorry?
How long does it take?
How long?
Yes, GRB blast wave to reach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Shock of the wind.
Okay. That depends on the radius R naught. Currently, I'm working with radius. The observed time, because we have to discriminate between the, you know, the real time and the observed time.
Yeah.
Observed time is the order of one day. Again, the order of, because as we had this discussion before, we don't know exactly what is R zero. R naught here could vary, you know, give or take an order of magnitude, and that will lead us to, you know, give or take an order of magnitude in the time. So I would say, you know, between few hours to few days. That's reasonable assumption. I'll get to that later. Okay. So that's to Ken's calculation. So what we know? We know from the self-similar, we know the boundary condition basically. We know from the Lorentz factor of the blast wave region A tilde S at gamma 1 which is just Lorentz factors it reached R naught. We know the density in region B because it was 4 times the density in region A, and so we know it. We know the density in region tilde, but everything else we don't know. And here comes the key point. No, maybe I'll go back one slide. Because you see, here, most of the time when you look at people that do calculations of shockwaves, they assume strong shockwaves. That is that the matter upstream before the shockwave is cold and the matter downstream is hot. But here, when you look at the reverse shock, right, if you look here, that's a good approximation. The strong shock approximation is good here, relatively good here. We've got, this is a cold wind and that's a hot wind, and so upstream matter is cold, downstream matter is hot. But now let's look at the reverse shock. Upstream now is region A tilde, which contains hot plasma, because this plasma passed through one shock wave. So this plasma is hot. And so the reverse shock separates between plasmas that are hot in region A tilde, and of course even hotter in region B tilde because it was heated by the shockwave. Okay, and so when you want to calculate the properties of this shockwave, you have to take this into consideration, and you cannot just use the approximation which, you know, many people used in the past, just men name Sari et al, there are several other works, of strong shockwave, because the reverse shockwave is not strong. Okay, so when we do this calculation, we have to do it precisely, and that is solving, we know the boundary conditions and we know the shock jump conditions. That's from thermodynamics, so we have the conservation of particle flux at both sides of the shocks, and the energy flux and momentum flux, and so omega is the enthalpy, gamma and beta, we know P is the pressure. And so given all that, we got some pretty ugly algebra, but when you do that, that's doable, and that's even doable analytically. You don't even need to use your computer to do that, and you plug it in, you solve it out, and when what we did find is that we could find gamma 2, which is the Lorentz factor of particles in region B and C, which is just 72% of the Lorentz factor gamma 1, the Lorentz factor of particles in region A at R naught. Basically, of course, what we want to know is the entire thermodynamical properties of matter in region B tilde and C tilde, so we could calculate the emission from these regions. So by solving these equations, we find gamma 2, we find the Lorentz factor of the reverse shock, which is important to know how long it takes the reverse shock to cross region A tilde, right? We know what's the width of region A tilde, so we need to know what's the velocity of the reverse shock so we can know when does it stop crossing it, which is, so the Lorentz factor of the reverse shock is about 40% of the Lorentz factor in region 1. We know the density in region B tilde, just step into me, nice number, the square root of 3, and the enthalpy in region B tilde, and so if you divide these numbers, you find out that the energy per particle in region B tilde is just 2.1 divided by square root of 3, which is about 20% higher than the energy per particle in region A tilde. So the reverse shock hits the particles, but only in 20%. Okay, so it's not a very strong shock. And once we know that, we can draw, again, a schematic view of the density during this phase. We got region A tilde, which moves at constant Lorentz factor, gamma 1. And then region B tilde and C tilde, which move at gamma 2, some densities, and into region B. And we got Lorentz factor gamma forward shock and gamma reverse shock, which we just calculated their values. And that led us to the second graph, which I wanted to show you, that I want you to take out of this talk. And this is the evolution of the blast wave Lorentz factor. And so again, as this would be R naught. So at earlier stages, the blast wave evolved into region A, which is characterized by density profile. So the Lorentz factor drops like R to minus half. When we get to R naught, this region A tilde, the shocked plasma, doesn't aware that something happened until the reverse recrosses it, so it continues to move at constant Lorentz factor, gamma 1, but the shock plasma move at gamma 2, which is 72% of that, and the reverse shock moves at 40% of that, and the reverse shock crosses the plasma region A tilde at radius R1, which is related to R0 by a simple numerical factor of about 6%. So R1 is the radius at which the reverse shock stop completely crossed the plasma, and then shortly afterwards, after that there is no reverse shock anymore, and shortly afterwards the blast wave continues and runs and asymptotes to a self-similar solution with gamma that goes like r to the minus 3/2. So it drops down. Of course, it's not exactly as I show here, but there is some phase until it goes to this asymptotic value. Do you understand how I get this graph? Okay. Once we know all these properties of the plasma, we can calculate the light curve, which is what we're interested in, basically, because this will be the observational consequences of all this. And so during these calculations, we just use the standard broken power law energy spectrum, which can be derived in many ways. One of the most well-known ones are Sarpuran and Narayan. It's the broken power law between several important frequencies, self-absorption frequency, the maximum frequency, and the cooling frequency. And when we do these calculations, we just have to separate between the different regions, emission and at the first stage when the blast wave propagates in region A, and then when the reverse shock exists, there are three different emitting regions. Region A tilde continues to emit, B tilde and C tilde. We just have to be a little bit careful about the details because there are also advected magnetic fields, so the actual magnetic field in region B tilde is a little bit higher than what you would expect just based on the standard assumption that the magnetic field is a given fraction of the energy density. And then at later on phase, you just have emission from one single, just from region C tilde, which is the only one that left after pressure crosses the plasma.
How does time run in this form of graph, the gamma function of R? How is time?
Yeah. Okay. The time is the observed time. What you're looking at is the observed time from the trigger. And so the time is just R over, there is Lorentz contraction, so the time would be just R over gamma square C. So you need to know the R, the radius, and gamma, the Lorentz factor at that radius. But that is given. So that's why I said that if R naught, we don't know, we're not certain about the value of R naught, we will not be certain about the value of the time. And so given that, I calculated the light curve, and I present here four light curves at different energy bands. We got the radial band, which is approximately around the self-absorption frequency. We got the mid-infrared band, which is 10 to the 12. I can't see it here. It's probably that one. And this is about the Ni-M, and we got the optical band. Sorry, that's mid-IR. That would be the optical band, and that will be the X-ray band. And basically what you see are two or three very important consequences of this model. One is that there is a jump in nearly all of the energy of the spectrum band from T0 to T1, which are the corresponding time for when the blast wave reached this continuity, by a factor of approximately 2, depending on exactly what energy band you're looking at. And that lasts for a few hours, given that T0 is the order of one day. That's one thing. The other thing is that the slope changes at early times and late times. And the slope at late times are looked, if you try to fit afterglow, as if the explosion occurs into a constant low density medium. Well, this was explained earlier. Why? And just as a theoretician, you know, I'm working on theories, but then I went to the literature and tried to see whether this was really observed. And the answer is Probably yes. And this is, well, apart from some discussions I had with some people, that's an hour band afterglow of GRBL-30329. That's a high-profile burst. And that was corrected from the contribution of supernova 2003DH. And that picture is taken from Lipkin et al. And indeed, you can see something that looks, to me at least, like a jump. That the factor is around 4. And that also occurs, that's optical bands, which should be comparable to the optical light curve, which is this, I believe, 10 to the 15 hertz, yeah. And so you indeed see something that could resemble this jump that we predict. So, to summarize, as I told you, this is a three graphs plot, so these are the three graphs. What I hope to try to convince you is that given that the progenitor of a gamma ray burst is an explosion of a massive star, then the wind from the massive star prior to its explosion is expected to give this complex density structure, that's wind bubble that was predicted already 30 years ago. And as the blast wave evolve into this complex density structure, the evolution of the Lorentz factor is expected to be different than the very simplified models used so far. And this has observational consequences, which are the most important ones are the jump by a small factor after about 1 day. But here again, I'm repeating, because we don't know the exact value of R naught here, then it would not surprise me, you know, this can be times or divided by 10. So it wouldn't surprise me if this jump would occur, you know, after an hour or after 10 days or something like that. And following that, we expect that the slopes will be different than the at late times and at earlier times. And that's what I wanted to tell you.
How strong your jump depends on the wind density and the ice intensity? Okay, let's assume you go with ice intensity from 10 meters to 10. What would be the jump?
It wouldn't matter at all. The density jump would change the radius of that.
Yeah.
And given that radius, that implies that the Lorentz factor of the blast wave as it reaches this radius is different, of course. It depends on the radius, the Lorentz factor.
So you say that it will not depend on the difference between density of your shocked wind and unshocked wind?
Because the jump here is expected to be by a factor of 4, because the reverse shock is strong, and so this is independent on the density here. And so the ratio here of 4.
So how would it change the ability to observe this density jump if your ISM density was 1, mm-hmm, rather than 10?
Well, I think that what would happen is that if you lower that significantly, that will run R naught pretty forward. So it will not be at 1 parsec, it will be at more than that. And if the Lorentz factor of the blast wave will not be relativistic at that stage, because at 1 parsec the Lorentz factor is the order of 20. So if you run and it goes like R to minus half.
If your initial Lorentz factor was
100. Yeah, 100 or something. Well, depending on the energy, right, it's a Pfund-Lucky solution. So depending what you assume about the energy. So it could be that the Lorentz factor is not relativistic enough. But at that point, also the Pfund-Lucky solution will fail. You have to go to the set of solution for non-relativistic blast wave evolution. So if it's too far away, then you probably won't be able to see much. Yeah.
So basically, if the interstellar medium has to be such a high density, then the progenitors to these objects would have to be embedded in whatever molecular cloud that gave them birth.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah.
Which
but
is only in our galaxy, right, there's only 1/10 of massive stars that are embedded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, but again, that goes to the motivation.
Yeah.
because that was called a negative amount of radiation, and McKee and all worked out many years ago that even if you had massive, I mean, a high density around it, it would actually clear out a high density region for almost like 10 to 50 parsecs, depending on the initial mass of the star. So you'd actually clear out this whole region where there would almost be nothing, but due to the luminosity, the sort of rocket effect, if you had clouds in the region, it would actually clear it out for a long time. So you, it's very hard to get this kind of a density. If you look at most Wolf Rayet bubbles,
we're star forming regions.
Well, you're talking about molecular clouds. Yeah. Then it's different. Yeah, I'm talking about if you have just a high density, it will clear it out.
Yeah. What I'm just saying is an observational fact that in our galaxy,
yeah, I agree.
90% are not in
molecular clouds. I agree. That's true. So I'm saying that even if you had high density, except if you had a huge big cloud, it would actually clear it out. And so it would be even. I agree with you.
So would how would it change then if you would like to get to 10? Would that change or what?
Well, yeah, the change would be that R naught will move from 1 parsec to, it goes like R to the 1/3. So it will move and to the 1/3, sorry.
You almost think that's better because then it's at later times and we have more time to get on there to see this jump. I mean, when does it move too far out that you're not going to see it?
Yeah.
Did you already answer that question?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. That if it's too far out, then the Lorentz factor of the blast wave when it reaches it is non-relativistic anymore.
What is too far out?
Well, we can calculate it. I mean, just given that at about 10 to the 18, the Lorentz factor is around 20. The Lorentz factor goes like R to the minus half, right, at the first stage. So if you go... it was still high enough.
It only gives you a factor of 3, right? Because you said the density goes like the 1.
Well, if you make the density 1 outside, then it will decrease by a factor of 1,000, which will increase the reverse shock by a factor of 10,
right,
which will increase your Lorentz factor by a factor of 3 point something, yeah.
Yeah, so you could still say it, yeah. So that would, yeah, so that's a real answer.
So, but now to get from your picture of gamma against R to your light curve, which we observe, you have to divide your R by gamma square at the time or something.
Yeah, you have to have the relation between the radius of the blast wave. Suppose you have a photons that emitted at R. Yeah. So you have T observed is just R over some factor, which is around 4, but... some factor, depends on what you assume exactly on the... Yeah, if it's toward you, of course.
Yeah.
It's aimed toward you. That's the Lorentz contraction. Of course, in reality, it takes the blast to you know, a few months to get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In reality, those shock regions, relatively unstable.
Sorry?
Relatively unstable in many
regions. Yeah. That's
how that, how much kind of crumpy if jump do you expect?
That I don't know. That I don't know. I can know that, you know, given the standard assumptions that radiation, you know, that some fraction epsilon E and epsilon B goes to radiation, then it's not radiation dominated. But if you start to insert instabilities, then it runs into something that I don't know how to calculate.
It could get a lot messier. And in addition, the mass loss rate is not constant. There's lots of burps in the mass loss rate. Mm-hmm. So it gets a lot messier, but I still like. You have a basic picture that, okay, it's going to get messier than the basic picture, but the basic picture is what,
you know. Yeah, that's what I was trying to tell you. I'm a theoretician, so I like cartoons.
Well, the reverse shock is not radically unstable, is it? You think? Mm. No, the reverse shock is not. The outer shock, the outer region becomes completely messy once you cross it, and I can show you where the whole thing becomes completely
messy. Yeah, here.
Yeah,
but it doesn't matter. But it doesn't matter because it doesn't go into this region.
In the shock wind region too, yeah. The whole thing outside the reverse shock, everything outside of it. Yeah.
Oh yeah, but it doesn't matter. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.